Okay, so my name is Tony Galippi. I'm the co-founder of BitPay. BitPay right now is a three-person company. It's myself, Steven, who's our CTO, and then Allison, who is our lovely face on all the videos that you see. Allison couldn't be here, but I brought her up on stage on the banner, so she at least was present. So my talk today is not going to be technical. I'm not a programmer. I'm an engineer and a business person. So my goal for Bitcoin and my reason for being here is more to drive adoption, to do the marketing. How can we get more people to use this technology that we're all excited about? And so I've got some ideas, and we're going to be doing some outreach programs that I'm going to share with you today. So if you were here yesterday and you went to the Hard Rock, you could buy beer with Bitcoins. How many of you guys did that? Yeah, okay, a few. We know the Wi-Fi sucked at the Hard Rock, but we all tried. And if you were lucky enough to get through, then you were, it was about like one Bitcoin for a beer. I think it was a pretty good rate. So this is a little mobile app that I made for the restaurant. It's got their name and logo on it, but when you're ready to close out your tab, this is all the restaurant needs to do. They just put in the check number, and they put in the amount that you have to pay, and you can select that in multiple currencies. We let them do it in Czech kroner. And then the next screen will generate the barcode. So when he hits the button, it pulls a real-time exchange rate, it creates a unique address, and displays a QR code that the customer would then scan and pay from their mobile wallet.
What's that check number?
Check number is like a ticket number. Like when you say check please, it has a ticket number from the point of sale system. That's how they track your orders. So that was fun yesterday. But let's talk about the general adoption. You know, what's taken so long? You know, we all think this is, you know, the best thing ever, right? We think it's a no-brainer. Everybody should use this. Why aren't they? Well, we've talked to a lot of people, and businesses, for the most part, they're hesitant to invest the time and resources in something that they still see as being experimental. Customers are not really seeing the benefits of this yet. And, well, the media and the politicians, they're all just really confused. Yes. No offense to any politicians in the audience. So let's talk a little bit about businesses, because I've talked to several hundred businesses, and why are they hesitant to incorporate this technology? Well, one reason, they say, gee, it's great, but nobody's asking for this. And if anything, if a business does anything well, they're going to listen to their customers or what their customers are asking for. And right now, customers, for the most part, are not asking for this. Second thing, it's great, but we're too busy. You know, we got 20 other projects we're trying to work on right now, and again, nobody's asking for this, so we're not going to do it. And the last part, it's great, but come back when it's more popular. So businesses that are accepting it now are typically the mom and pop, one and two person businesses that can make the simple decisions. If you want to get wider adoption at a place like the Hard Rock, or at places where you can shop every day in the mall, a company that has more than one or two employees, you know, you have to make it, you have to present the business case to them that this is beneficial to them and to their customers. Consumers. You know, one of the things that they asked me after I explained it, well, like, how is this any different from PayPal? This is a good starting point. If they're familiar with PayPal, then you can kind of lead into how Bitcoin is better. This is a valid concern. It's too hard to buy Bitcoins, especially in certain countries. No. The price is too volatile, and I'm not a currency trader, right? I'm not a trading junkie. I don't know how to manage currencies. So I'm confused by this. And the last one is kind of a snobby attitude, but they think that chargebacks and fraud don't affect them. You know, but they don't realize that all the shoplifting and fraud and theft, they pay for it in the form of higher prices. Okay. But some people don't see it that way. So when we're trying to refine our message to talk to new people about Bitcoins, one of the things you want to focus on is not really what it is or how it works, but why should somebody use this, right? Why should they care? You know, why can this benefit them? So we made a little video, and I'm going to play it here. I'm going to try to hold the microphone up to let you see the sound. And it's about a minute long. Okay, I'll just play it. Thank you. Well, I'd love you to hear Alice's great voice, but I may just have to narrate it myself. I wrote the script, so I'm familiar with it. All right, so what's so great about Bitcoin? Well, consumers love Bitcoin because it's more convenient and than carrying cash. It's more private and more secure than cash or credit cards. And there's no risk of identity theft. If you lose your card, if you lose your Bitcoin wallet, people can't access your money unless they have your password. Businesses like it too, because it's lower risk and lower hassle than taking cash or credit. Certainly lower fees than accepting a credit card or a debit card. And a business can take a payment from any person anywhere in the world without a risk of fraud. So it's better than cash because you can get Bitcoins in any country. They can't be counterfeited or diluted. You can use them online or person to person. And there's no central bank. There's no single point of failure. So we like to call Bitcoin tomorrow's money. You know, you can send money like you send an email to anybody in the world, anytime, without going through a bank. The transactions are private and irreversible. And you can also back up your money, which is something you can't do with your cash. So what are the three main ways that you can use Bitcoins? Well, you can shop with your Bitcoins in any country. You can save them as an investment. Or you can send money to anyone, anywhere, at any time. So how do you get started? The easiest way is to open an account at an exchange. You know, you can deposit your local currency into the exchange, and then you can buy Bitcoins. You can buy them right away, or wait until you need to send them. And if you'd like to learn more, you can visit our website, bit-pay.com. So, I'm no Allison, but so we like to think of this as a nice message, and we're going to be refining this. And there's a flyer that was in your packet. This one here. So we're going to be printing these. And certainly there's room on the bottom for a lot more logos and a lot more people to participate in this Bitcoin outreach. Because BitPay as a merchant service, we're not an exchange. We're not in the business of selling Bitcoins to people. So we really have no vested interest in this other than to make this technology more popular. So Roger from Memory Dealers has agreed to team up with me to print some of these and to pay for some advertising. Arthur Brito, formerly of Exchange Bitcoins, has been big part of this project in coordinating the outreach. I think Arthur or I may have been in touch with a couple people in this room. We've shared a Google document with you that kind of outlines our plan and what our mission is. So this is something we'd like to do, right? It doesn't tell anybody how it works or what it does. It just says, you know, why should you use this? And so this is something that we're going to start doing, and you know, we're going to make more of these, and we certainly would like people's input. You know, as you're talking to people face to face, what are they confused about? How can we make it easier? You know, how can we focus on the message? Why should somebody use this? So when you talk to people, focus on the usability, like I just said. Great example. You don't have to need to know how an engine works to drive a car. You know, this lady putting on her lipstick as she's driving down the road can drive a car just fine, but she doesn't really know how the engine works. Okay. People that use email. They don't have to know how the email gets from point A to point B, but they use email every day. So focus on the usability. You know, talk about how people can use Bitcoins, not how they work. You know, I have this iPad, and I love this thing. And whenever I show it to my friends and family, and I show them all the great things that it can do, never once do they ask me, well, how does it work? And I honestly couldn't tell them, because I don't know how it works. It just does, and it works great. And I like the thing. So, you know, if you focus more on the big picture of why somebody should use this, how can they use it, I think you're going to start to reach more of the non-technical users. You know, and anybody can enjoy the benefits of Bitcoin without knowing anything about Bitcoins. You know, especially from a business standpoint. With some of the services we provide, you know, we cash out their Bitcoins for dollars immediately. So they can take this money from the customer, but they get dollars into their bank account, just like they get from running a credit card. But they enjoy all the benefits. No chargebacks, no fraud, lower fees. So one of the other things I like to talk about, the price of Bitcoins does not matter. It's completely irrelevant. You know, this is one thing that the media always likes to hype on, and I'll talk about this in a minute. You know, there's a very simple way to use Bitcoins where you can eliminate all of your currency risk. Does anybody know how to do this?
Or you buy and sell it.
Yeah.
You you source the price based on the current exchange rate, not in a fixed Bitcoin amount.
Somewhat, yeah.
Don't convert them back, it's easy.
Partly, no, you want it. That's one thing. But let's say I buy $200 worth of Bitcoins, and the price is $2.50, and I buy the Bitcoins. Tomorrow the price is $2, right? I just lost one fifth of my purchasing power. Okay, so that's what scares some people, because they see the chart and they see it going down. There's a very simple way to use Bitcoins and maintain your purchasing power, and it's a simple thing. Only buy your Bitcoins at the exact moment you have to send them. You know, put money in your exchange account in dollars or euros, just leave it there, dollars or euros. And only buy the Bitcoins at the exact moment that you have to send them. When you receive Bitcoins, sell them right away. You know, so nobody's holding Bitcoins for more than a couple of seconds. So you're not exposing yourself to any currency risk. You know, Bitcoins are not a buy and hold investment, as we all know. And so any media or reporter that talks about Bitcoin and everybody that loses their money because it went from $30 to $2 and oh my gosh, you know, the thing is crashing, they're missing the point. So I'll say it again, you know, the price of Bitcoins, it's irrelevant, you know. Because what is Bitcoin? Is it a currency? What is it real? There was a reporter that was interviewing Cassatius, the guy that makes those little physical Bitcoins, and she was all harping on him about, oh my gosh, the price is crashing, people are using money. He's like, you're missing the point. Bitcoin is the easiest way to get money from point A to point B. That's what it is. I took that one step further and I said, you know what? Bitcoin is the most efficient form of money transfer ever invented. You know, it just happens to be its own currency, but it's a very efficient form of transferring money. I'm going to steal this quote from Rick, who's about to talk a little bit later. You know, he mentioned this on an interview with Max Kaiser on television, and he said, Bitcoin will do to the global banking system what email did to the postal service. I'm not going to steal Rick's thunder, but he's going to talk about that this afternoon. So let's just talk about just general technology innovation. You know, we live in the digital age. In the 20th century, if I was here and I wanted to send 5 letters to people around the world, I'd have to go to the post office. I'd have to put postage on every letter. It would cost me a lot of money. And it would take about a week to get there. News, information, content, music, movies. The old way of getting your news and information was to print it on a piece of paper and hand deliver it around. The old way we used to buy music is they would burn it onto a mechanical disc and deliver it around to a store where you would go shopping. Banks. You know, how do we use banks? Well, we send money back and forth. Send money internationally is very expensive through the banking system. But we live in the digital age. So what do we do now? If I want to send 5 letters from Prague everywhere in the world, I can just compose an email and I hit send, and it goes. It's free, and it's instant. Content. You know, newspapers, music. You can all download the stuff digitally now. You know, it's common. So how does this play into the banking system? Well, you know, Bitcoin is a digital money transfer. You know, it's no different than a digital message or digital content. You know, and so if you can use it in a way that minimizes the risk to the person and use it specifically as a money transfer, then you can really get more wider adoption. Because not everybody is a Forex currency expert, not everybody is a computer programmer. And this is my personal belief, is that, you know, mass adoption of this technology is going to be inevitable, because the efficiencies are so great, right? For me to go to the bank and send $20 to another country, it's gonna cost me $40 to send $20. You know, and the person that receives it, they're gonna deduct $20 from the $20 that they received, and they get nothing. So, you know, the banks really are the ones that are concerned about this. You know, Bitcoin is not a threat to the dollar or the euro. Bitcoin is a threat to the traditional banking system that just overcharges for nothing more than storing the money, storing your number in a database. So how do we reach mass adoption? You know, we already have the Unix geeks. You know, everybody that's tinkering with us, we understand that. So it's not ready for grandma yet. We all know that. But it's probably ready for the next wave of users. So who are the likely people that we can approach next? Libertarian groups, Ron Paul supporters, guys at the end of Fed crowds, Tea Party crowds. You know, any of these Max Kaiser financial anarchists that they like to call themselves. Those guys would like this. You know, foreign students. You know, if you're a student in a foreign country, you always have to send money back and forth to your parents, and using Western Union is very expensive. You know, immigrants that send money back home. Again, same thing. It's very expensive to go to Western Union. You know, if Bitcoin is adopted on both sides of the transaction, they can just send their money and bypass Western Union and do it for free. PayPal users, I said this again, PayPal has what? How many million users? And those people know how to send and receive money online. So for them to learn how to use our device, and once they know the benefits of it, they're going to adopt it much quicker. You know, especially when you find a disgruntled PayPal user, and there's a lot of them that have had their account frozen or seized or whatever that has happened to them. You know, gold and silver bucks. This is another likely group, right? These are people that already understand that the fiat currency may be in trouble, and they're looking for other ways to store their wealth. So they buy gold and silver. But you can't send gold and silver over the internet. So how do you do that? You know, Bitcoin has a lot of properties, you know, because of its supply. It's very similar to gold. And so these people might be able to be educated that this is how you can transact electronically, you know, and send money that's not US dollar, because these people don't like US dollar. So here's my goal. And Roger and I and Arthur have talked about this, and we certainly want to get more people into our effort. But our goal is to reach 1 million Bitcoin users. Let's get 1 million people using Bitcoin before Apple releases their digital wallet. Okay. And we think we got a year, because Apple just released a phone, and they typically release a phone once every year. And the new phone that they just had, there's no wallet in it. So we think we have a year. And so this is what we're doing. We have a new website that we're starting, and I'll show it to you here. It's going to be a portal that mimics this brochure that I showed you. It's going to be lovebitcoins.org. And the point of this website is to send people where they can get started. You know, this is not a wiki. This is not a directory. You're not going to send people on a two-hour journey if they're ready to get started after 1 minute. You know, so make it very simple. This video I just showed you is right on the front page, and then the link, click here to get started. So it's not a very cluttered site. It's very intuitive. I click this, I click that. And then on the get started page, this is where we point people. You know, if you're a consumer, this is how you can get Bitcoins. And we're undecided whether we want to do it by payment method or by country, but we may organize this a little bit differently. And the same thing for merchants. You know, you either want to get some Bitcoins or you want to start accepting Bitcoins. You know, what are the simple steps to do this? And we're gonna add more partners into this. We're gonna have more contribution. And you know, my goal is to start doing some online advertising for this site. And I'd like to get 1,000 unique visitors a day to come to this site. Check it out, watch the video. You know, Stefan has had 800,000 people watch this video, which is great. You know, but Stefan says everybody wants their Bitcoin business listed on my site, and I don't know these people, I can't do that. You know, this is something where we're gonna selectively pick the partners that we know are the right places to steer new users. So we're gonna be selective here. And so right now, you know, the only two people on the list are me and Roger from Memory Dealers. But we're going to be adding more members as well. And so my idea for this, eventually, if it takes off, is to make it more like a chamber of commerce type model, right? Where you as a business, you donate, and then the group collectively promotes the entire group. So, you know, we can incorporate this as a nonprofit. We can do a lot of different things. But I think the idea is that, you know, you can pay to become a member, you know, however many Bitcoins a year, and then you get listed, and then you can participate. You have your link on this site, and you participate in the advertising. We'll have a little section on here to help people get started and learn about Bitcoins, but again, it's not going to be a wiki. It's just going to be a little bit more in-depth with the bullet points that you see. The other thing we will have is a media kit. So, you know, new reporters that are looking to write about Bitcoin, we're going to give them a list of quotes that they can just use with credit. You know, use any of these with the author, and you're fine. I want to have this section here called Common Misreporting About Bitcoin. It's going to be like a Snopes style or a fact check type information about, you know, why is the Bitcoin price going down? You know, or, you know, isn't Bitcoin used for illegal activities? Well, you know, we can present some facts to kind of dispute some of those, you know, misreportings. We'll also offer a link if they want to interview us. We can, you know, point them in the right direction. How many of you heard the interviews that Roger did on Free Talk Live Radio? He did it last week. Roger from Emory Dovers. Okay. He's a really good interview. He can explain Bitcoins really well. You can tell he's enthusiastic. I mean, he puts up billboards, and he spends a lot of his own money just to promote Bitcoin, even though it's such a small part of his business. So guys like that, you know, we'd like to get out and talk to CNN, because they're very aggressive, they're in their face, and they're not afraid to tell the commentator, no, you're wrong, this is what it really is. Sometimes the reporters are a little bit, they're not astute technically. I remember a lot of misreporting when the internet first came out. You know, all the news reports were, the internet is dangerous, the internet is bad, you know, don't use it, be careful. And eventually, look, everybody got over it. And now all the reports about Bitcoin, you can probably take the same exact story from 20 years ago and look at it today and say, Bitcoin is bad, Bitcoin is dangerous. It's the same story, it's the same thing. So we'd like to educate the media, because I think if the message really gets out, you know, the media is here really to serve the people, not to serve the banks. At least we hope so. And the last thing I'll talk about, you know, we have this calendar here, so we'll put a list of all the meetup groups. So, you know, you can just go to meetup.com and you can find a local Bitcoin meetup in your area, and you can start by just meeting local people that use this technology. We'll also have a list of the events. Obviously, we're here at the European Bitcoin Conference. The next big event is the Consumer Electronics Show, which is in Las Vegas. It's the biggest electronics, you know, event in the world. BitPay, we have a booth, and Mt. Gox also has a booth. So we're going to be promoting Bitcoin, and I don't know how many reporters. I think there's 10,000 reporters that are going to be coming through there. So we'll be happy to educate them and teach them how to use Bitcoins. By then, hopefully, there will be a nice little wallet that we can just let the reporters get started with and play with in our booth. We'll see. But that's the idea. So how do we reach out to consumers, merchants, the media, all with the goal of getting 1 million users? Because if we reach that level, you get to the point where the regulations do not matter. You know, they can try to ban it all they want. Once you have 1 million people, you have a critical mass. So they can't put you in jail. They can't fine you if you're using something. If it's only a handful of people, yeah, they can crack down on it. But once it spreads too widely, they can't. So that's another thing. You know, if we really get mass adoption, you know, then the regulations become a moot point. It would be like the post office trying to fine you or throw you in jail for sending an email. You know, they're going to try. The banks are going to try to fine you and throw you in jail for using Bitcoins, but can they really? You know, especially if 1 million people are using it. They're not going to throw 1 million people in jail. So that's all I have today. If you have any other questions, I guess Amir can pass around the microphone.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Actually, I do have some questions.
Okay.
One of the things you said is Bitcoin is lower risk, but now because the market rate of Bitcoin is fluctuating so wildly, there's a lot of volatility in the market. And so when there's a lot of volatility and you're a merchant in the price of goods and Bitcoins, in order to protect yourself against that volatility, you have to have a higher spread, you have to have a markup on the price. So when you said that Bitcoin is more efficient and lower risk and it costs less in the long run, maybe you can elaborate on that and explain to people what you mean by that.
Sure. Well, merchants can price their value of their goods in any currency they want. And for a while, it's probably going to be very unlikely that a merchant would price their goods in Bitcoins because they are so volatile. So if they're selling a product and the product is normally 10 euros, you know, they can sell it for Bitcoins, the amount of Bitcoins that are worth 10 euros. The exchange rate can be pulled at the time of sale. So the merchant really doesn't have a whole lot of volatility risk because, you know, as soon as they receive the Bitcoins, they can sell them and they can get pretty darn close to the $10 of euros that they were expecting. One of the parts of the equation that isn't quite developed yet is how do you eliminate the risk for the buyer? How can I keep just $100 in my Mt. Gox wallet as $100? And when I want to spend my Bitcoins, just buy the market price of Bitcoins and send them right away. You know, the exchanges and the wallets kind of need to come together to help eliminate the risk for the buyer. You know, the buyer should only be holding Bitcoins for a minimal amount of time as possible, because as we know, you know, Bitcoins are not a viable investment. So, you know, we're not quite there yet. I think the exchanges and the wallets probably need to come together to work on that. I would call it like a spend function, right? You have a wallet that can do a buy, a sell, a send, and a receive. Those are your four basic functions of a wallet that's connected to an exchange. I'd like to see a fifth one, which would be what I would call a spend. You know, spend from my dollar balance, but send bitcoins. You know, and this is something that can be very easily to incorporate. We're already talking to a few exchanges, and they're very interested in it. Because we can eliminate the risk for the merchant side, and if there's a solution to eliminate the risk for the buyer side, then everybody wins.
So one question people will ask is, you know, oh, why shouldn't I use PayPal? So maybe you can explain to people what is the problem with using something like PayPal, especially in virtual goods and services.
Yeah. So PayPal has a system where they always side with the customer regardless. So as a business, it's very risky for you to accept a PayPal payment from somebody that you don't know. And I was talking to Stacy about this last night. You know, she receives PayPal payments for some of her films. And, you know, occasionally she'll get somebody that complains to PayPal and will threaten to seize her account, and PayPal forces her to buy insurance. And for somebody sending her $5, if they're sending it internationally, she only gets about $3 of that $5. The rest of it goes to PayPal. So PayPal does not work very well across international borders. There are many countries that PayPal will not support, pretty much anywhere in Africa. Iran. You know, India now, they're starting to crack down on it and say you can't have more than a certain amount of money in your PayPal account. The government is cracking down on it. So for people that are using PayPal, it's very risky for the business because they can get a chargeback, they can get their account frozen. And anybody that Googles, you know, PayPal seizures, you'll see people have had thousands of dollars, tens of thousands of dollars, you know, seized from their account. And yeah, good luck hiring a lawyer to go up against eBay. That's a tough battle.
So the name of this is called Friendly Fraud. And if you sell any kind of virtual good or service on the internet, and the person you're selling to initiates a chargeback, then PayPal will ask you to provide proof of the sale, and typically they want a tracking code or a tracking number. And if you can't provide that, they automatically side with the customer. So that's what it means. Okay, so you were talking earlier about you're talking about trying to get over the message of Bitcoin. Like, what is a good structure for an argument that you would use? Like, how would you structure your typical argument talking to someone about why you like Bitcoin? Just a quick run.
I mean, I tell people, you know, do you remember when you got your first email account? You know, what'd you do with it? Right? You just started emailing all your friends all the time. And so, imagine if you could just do the same thing with money. You know, you have a bank account now, and you can start sending money anywhere in the world, anytime, and people can send you money. You know, small amounts. Send 50 cents to someone in Australia. Send $1. Just start playing with it. Because when you got email, you just started playing with it. And trying to explain email to someone was kind of difficult. I remember trying to tell my dad. I said, Dad, you should get an email account. He said, why would I want that? Right? Well, so I can email you. Why would I want that? So eventually, I just signed him up, and I showed him how it worked. And once he started using it, he got it. So Bitcoin is one of those things where it's abstract, it's confusing to people. But the easiest way is to just show them how to use it. You know, I show them on my phone. Look, I can send money to my friend in Japan right now, and he's going to get it in about a minute, and it doesn't go through a bank. So just showing them how it is used, I think, is more effective than trying to argue and explain the technology.
So you went, I really liked at the end when you went through, this list of like people that have been naturally receptive to Bitcoin, people that, you know, like you can target and talk to, like, you know, Unix hackers, programmable people, and so on. But then in the beginning of the talk, you was actually talking about arguing Bitcoin just on its benefits, you know, just on its usability. And the thing is, it's a, you see like these poker sites with the gamblers or whatever, they don't care about fees or whatever, they just want to put money in, you know, and start gambling. They want something that makes them feel good, you know, they get that rush straight away. And maybe like a way to put forward Bitcoin is arguing it as a revolutionary tool, you know, saying that look, you can now exist in a system without having to depend on, you know, something that is almost universally hated, the banks. Like I came to Prague and I only had €5 in my pocket, but I can exchange bitcoins with everyone here. I've done that in London, Amsterdam, and everywhere. So it's now possible to
to build our own systems.
Yeah, I mean, I look forward to the day a few years from now when I can leave my home in the U.S. and I can fly to London and not have to trade my money in. I can fly again to Prague, not have to trade my money in, go to Dubai, go to Tokyo. And all I have to do is just have Bitcoins on my phone and I can do everything I need. Because every time you go to that little kiosk and that person, you know, you lose so much money, right? And when you leave a country, whatever you have left in your pocket, you have to spend it or you lose it because you don't get anything for it. So, you know, Bitcoins, you know, when you talk about international travelers and international business travelers, for those guys, it makes a lot of sense. Because they end up just chomping and blowing their money before they get on a plane to go home. And that's just wasteful.
So you also mentioned this guy, Roger Ver, throughout the talk, but you didn't really like explain who he is and what he thought, so maybe you can expand a bit.
Right. So Roger is the guy from Memory Dealers. You know, he's the guy that put up the billboard in Silicon Valley. You know, he has a website where he sells computer memory components and Bitcoin, you know, mining equipment and things like that. But he's a real Bitcoin advocate, and he's one of the guys like me that is just really trying to educate people and to get people to start using this technology. So him and I teamed up, and he said, "Look, I'll help you pay for the flyers." You know, he started a program now where he'll sell you those physical Cassatius Bitcoins with PayPal or credit card. So he figured out a way that, you know what, if I ship something to somebody and they have to sign for it, then I'm not going to get a chargeback. So, you know, look, people may try to abuse it. He's going to try it, see if it works. I give him credit for it. You know, he's just trying to get Bitcoins in more people's hands. He goes on the radio and explains, you know, how people can use this. You know, the Free Talk Live, the group that he talked to is in New Hampshire, part of the Free State Project. Very libertarian group. They're interested in Bitcoins, but they still are kind of confused on how it works. And the interview he gave with them, I thought was very good.
Yeah. Well, just one quick point you were saying about the media before is, you know, like, yeah, one of the things is they like sound bites. So, like, when we went to the CNBC, like, I went with, like, Donald Norman, and he was trying to expand on, you know, these long points about why Bitcoin is so important and so needed, and they just wanted quick sound bites. So, like, one thing that I like to say is Bitcoin is democratic money. You know, democracy has
like
feel good
one. Can I use that quote on the list here? Okay.
Sure.
All right. So.
Yeah. You was also talking about the banks. So the one thing is that, you know, the banks are not a monolithic entity. There is a difference between, you know, the messaging systems used between banks, the clearing houses, and the institutions themselves. So one thing is we were recently at the conference for SWIFT. And one of the big topics there was banking 2.0, where they were talking about the fact that banks are not adapting to new technology, and that there's all these new technologies that banks should be taking advantage of. And one of the things that they were actually talking about is how can SWIFT is the messaging network used worldwide between banks to send payments, was how could we use a system like Bitcoin? So maybe there is some way there that, okay, banks as an institution, which are taking people's money and holding them, is maybe against Bitcoin, but banks, the services which transfer money between banks, maybe are more positive.
Yeah. Okay, so if you look at Bitcoin as money transfer, I'll give you two examples. One is Western Union, right? Everybody knows Western Union. You can send money anywhere in the world using Western Union. When you think about it, Western Union could use Bitcoin behind the scenes and not tell anyone. They can still charge the customer $40 to transfer the money. They can still charge the recipient. Maybe they do, maybe they don't. And they can do the transfer for free and they can not tell anybody. You know, somebody else could come up with a competitor to Western Union and charge, you know, the same service for a lot less money, and then Western Union would have to adopt. Banks, the same thing. You know, banks could use Bitcoin behind the scenes as a method of international transfer. They don't have to tell anyone. You know, they can still charge you $40 for that wire transfer, but they could use Bitcoin. If they got smart, they'd probably offer it for $5. And I think the general public would still pay $5 for an international transfer. It's better than $40. But the banks are now getting it virtually for free. So one thing you need really to do larger dollar amounts, you need more liquidity on the exchanges. You know, the day traders help, but you really need more people buying and selling. But if the banks are in there all day long buying and selling because they're doing transfers, that'll help. So, you know, who does international transfers? You know, the banks do that. Western Union does that. And so either they are going to adopt to this and they recognize it, you know, or they're going to be replaced. But they can adopt this and they can still make money. because they can still charge a customer $5 for an international transfer, and the customer thinks they're getting a great deal because yesterday they paid $40.
Right. Well, so Rick has a question.
I just had a comment that if you look at telco, they're in the same position as banks are, that they're charging for international connections. And you can see that most of the telcos have already gone to an IP infrastructure, but they're still charging as if they were in a circuit infrastructure, which means that when I place a call to China, they're getting something like a 150,000% markup on that call, which is why I believe the telcos are going to go the same way as the banks eventually. But just an observation that some have figured this out, but they haven't yet figured out that they also have to slash their prices.
Yeah. And then a company like Skype comes along, and what does that do to the big telecom companies? Right now, you can use Skype for free for voice and video calls anywhere in the world.
Well, we were in Amsterdam, and this was like before the Times article came out for Bitcoin. We really wanted to send some US dollars to the UK with GBP. And to do that, we went around everywhere, and the only places that would do that was Western Union and MoneyGram. And the only way to do it is to change our dollars to euros to pounds. And they say there's no fee. When we looked at the markup on the price, we were paying 20%. 20%, that's so disgusting. You send £2,000 and you pay £400 for that transfer. There is no reason why sending money around the world should cost anything. It's just some person behind the desk entering some numbers.
I like that quote.
Our next speaker is David Birch. He's a consultant, he's a money consultant. He's done like these interviews for the BBC, and actually the reason why I found him was because he was doing a talk that I was very interested to attend the day before this conference. But I obviously couldn't make it, so he's going to be talking about payment systems.
I work for a company called Consult Hyperion, which is a specialist in telecom transactions consultancy. And we work on scale, mass market electronic transaction systems. So to give you an idea of some of the things that we've been involved in, they would be things like M-Pesa down in Kenya, where we were consulting for Vodafone. That's a system that's 14 million users at the moment. That's a third of the 100 GDP going through it. We're the consultants to Transport for London for the new ticketing systems. There, that's probably 22,000 gates at the moment. Buses and subways, moving over to EMV cards for next year. We work for Orient and Barclaycard on the first NFC phone service delivered in the UK. So what I'm interested in is scale systems. And so the question is, can Bitcoin find a niche where it can achieve some kind of scale? And that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to make one or two suggestions. Now, actually, you mentioned the comments you can't read. Does this one work? There we go. I spoke at a conference to some bankers. I feel a bit of an arms dealer, really. I spoke at a conference to bankers earlier in the week. And what I'm going to do, I'm going to top and tailor slightly differently, but I'm going to tell you the same five areas where I think a new payment system could get some traction in the near future. So it's not like I'm telling you some secret message. I mean, you know, you're not the only people that are looking to develop new payment systems and trying to find a niche. So here we go. Now, if you think that if you think that you're going to sell Bitcoin to the mass market because the general public wants an anonymous, irreversible, cryptographically strong, prepaid electronic cash replacement system, I can prove to you absolutely they don't, and you're completely wasting your time. Because this is me at the launch of the Mondex electronic purse in the UK in 1995. MasterCard spent something in the region of $150 million trying to see if the general public wanted an anonymous, irreversible, cryptographically strong, prepaid electronic purse. And I can tell you categorically that they didn't. I think one of the, I don't want to sort of sound like the grey-haired, elderly, you know, doom monger, but I just want, you guys look kind of young. I don't know if you remember Danmon, DigiCash, Simeca, Send, Visa Cash, and all of the other first generations of Tenster. You know, things that didn't work are valuable, and I think one slight problem is, particularly in banks actually, things that didn't work, you know, they just get covered up and forgotten, and nobody ever learns any of the lessons. And now we're back looking at this area again, and I think it's important to take on board some of those lessons from last time. So, right, so my value to you is that I've also worked on things that didn't work on a large scale. Just, right, so let me begin. So here's my agenda. So what's going on in the real world? So just as a benchmark, before we start talking about all the fantastic things that we're going to do, just think for a second about the real world. I know that's hard. There's a guy wearing a Kraftwerk t-shirt in the back. But if we let the real world interject for a moment, so this is what's going on in the real world. That's a picture of the real world. That's me at my train station trying to catch the train into London. This is the prosaic, it's not about buying things from China, you know, with minimum friction. For the real world, right, it's me trying to get on a train to come to London. And I just want you to look at this picture, because that's the slot where you used to pay with payment cards. And that's been taped up, right? So you can't pay with payment cards at my train station. And the reason why you can't pay with payment cards isn't because of Bitcoin, it's because of mobile phones. Because everybody that parks there uses this, which is the mobile phone system. So when you park your car, you go get on the train, and you call the number, and you punch in your number, or you run the app on your iPhone, in which case it uses the location to work out which car park you're in, and you pay like that. And if you buy a £2 ticket on a Sunday, you pay £2.40. It's 20% transaction fee. And you know what? I'm happy to pay that. And so is everybody else, because more than half of the parking slots at the train station are paid for like that. You know, it's not an issue of payment. It's not an issue of cost. It's an issue of convenience. Is, are you delivering something that makes life better for people? And because I don't need to take coins to the train station, and I can just go sit on the train and use the app on the train, I couldn't care less about paying 20, 30, 40 cents or whatever it's going to pay. I just don't care, right? And so what you want is a target market of people who don't care, right? Like me, because then you can charge them more. So you need to... but this is the real world, right? Go look at the statistics. How do people pay for things now? They pay using cash, which is falling very slowly. They pay using debit cards, which are climbing, 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 climbing. The preferred method of payment for the average person in Europe is a debit card. And what's coming next is mobile phones. So let's just focus, this is the real world, right? Let's talk about five. I've picked out five areas where the current payment systems don't work as well as they could, and where there might be an opportunity for people who were of a technical disposition who could come up with something better to move into these places. So the first, and that's phones, friends, kids, fraud, freedom. Okay, so let's do phones first of all. So why phones? Well, because people will be using phones in shops anyway, right? So when you go into a shop to buy something now, you've got your phone in your hand, because if you're not scanning the barcodes to see if it's cheaper on Amazon, you're talking to your mum or texting your mates or whatever. You have your phone in your hand anyway. So it's a very small step to turn phones into the payment device as well. This is actually from last year. So this is, me buying something with my iPhone in Palo Alto in California last year. That iPhone actually has a little sticker on the back. It's a MasterCard prepaid RFID sticker, which is a fantastically convenient way of paying. So you know, you don't have to be like a radical or a revolutionary to understand this. If your roadmap is based on anything other than phones, then you're wrong. Okay? So people like you, who are using PCs and web browsing and writing code, you are a vanishingly small minority. There are 5.1 billion people out there right now with mobile phone subscriptions, and that should be your target market. People who use PCs, who cares? People who use PCs, that's people like me. We're dying out, okay? My kids don't, well, they do use a PC, but they only use it for playing Call of Duty. If they're doing anything important, like communicating or whatever, they do it all on smartphones, right? So if you have a technology roadmap, which is anything other than phones, you're wrong.
Is that phones or smartphones?
I think for your market, it's smartphones. But you need to be phone... Again, I'm just telling you the same thing I would tell anybody else that's looking at a payments business now. You've got to be phone-centric. And phone-centric means something a little different from just being able to browse or use a web services API on the phone. Because the guy you're going to be competing with will be using the characteristics of the phone channel, which are secure storage, whether it's in the SIM under the control of the operator, or in the handset under the control of Google or Apple, location-based services and GPS, these kind of things. You have to integrate those to the part of the service. I'll talk more about that. So this is why it's, I've got to find sound bites, right? Because I took on board the last presentation, so everything has to be reduced to sound bites. So the sound bite is spontaneous commerce, commerce that can be done anywhere. This is my picture, so I've got handy little pictures to help you remember it. You see how I'm making it user-friendly? So this is my picture for you to... this is a picture of the 21st century, if you want one. That's actually in Botswana. That's a cafe in Botswana. Look at what they're at. Look at what the cafe in Botswana is selling. Digital download of authorized content only, I'm sure. Internet very close. Oh, by the way, it's soft drink. That's the last thing on the cafe's menu. It's drinks. And you also notice... the subtitles are in Chinese. So this is a picture of the 21st century. That's in Botswana right now. I mean, this is the level of sophistication of that market already. 5.1 billion people with mobile phone subscriptions. There's only 4 billion people with toothbrushes. Okay, the second thing, friends, right? So I thought I'd use my son as an example. He doesn't know I'm doing this. But that's my eldest son. This is one of my very favourite pictures because this is the first time they ever got paid for a gig, as I believe they're called. Right? So him and his friends, they're in a band. Who isn't? Right? The global music industry is bigger than it's ever been at any point in history. Every teenager is in a band. He's in a band. So with other bands, they organise these concerts. They hire a space. There's no promoter, no organiser, no central. They just do it, and the way they do it, which I thought was quite interesting because I didn't know about this, young persons like you are probably more familiar with this kind of arrangement. So what they do is they sell tickets, and the first, whatever it was, I can't remember, the first 20 tickets go to the top band on the bill, and then the next 20 tickets go to the second band, the next 20 tickets go to the third band. And this was their first thing, they were the fifth band on the bill. Like, there's no hope they're going to get paid. You know what, they got £20. So it makes a father proud. I'd still prefer him to study a little harder for his medicine, but this is okay. So what's the point about that? The point about that is that all happened without any central organisation. This was all done through Facebook and instant messaging and text messaging and MySpace, and they did it all themselves. Nobody did it for them. Nobody organised this commerce for them. They just did it themselves. And it's interesting, it's a continuous kind of conversation. You know, this is a constant, ongoing conversation that they're involved in. Somebody else was talking about asynchronous. These are asynchronous conversations, but they're continuous asynchronous conversations that organise this. So this is what I call streaming commerce. It's something that's constantly going on. Constantly, if it was working properly, it would be sending little bits of money backwards and forwards. Because for those kids, the money, everything worked perfectly. You know, the gig worked perfectly, and the tickets worked perfectly, and the bands worked perfectly, and the audience came, and everybody got paid. The thing that didn't work was the payments. The payments were a nightmare, because it all ended up as
Oh, you know, can your dad PayPal some money to my dad? Oh, wait, if somebody gave me some cash, if I give you the cash, could your mum put it into a bank account for me? You know, I haven't got a PayPal account. Most of these kids didn't even have bank accounts. But, you know, everything worked except the payments, right? So somehow payments have to work into that streaming model. So I thought I'd give some, because anybody who's been following the hashtag is, they would discover I'm completely obsessed with Twitter. It's a medical condition. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. But I'm completely obsessed with Twitter. So, you know, if Twitter has an API, I mean, why not start with something like that? You know, why can't I follow my Bitcoin wallet on Twitter and see what it's up to? Why can't you send me a DM me when you do something, or send me a tweet or something like that? This is one of the things I was saying to the bankers was, you know, you were saying earlier on about, well, people hate banks and blah, blah. They sort of do. They sort of hate them, but they trust them because they're regulated financial institutions. So, you know, I don't want to be friends with my bank. That would be stupid. I hate them, right? Because I'm a normal person. But I wouldn't mind being friends with my bank account, right? So if I could have some social networking connection with my money, that would be a little different. That would generate an intimacy and a continuous relationship. So have a look at things like Twitter as the basis for some of these things. I have to say, my kids don't use Twitter either. They don't use email, they don't use, you know, they do everything on Facebook and by instant messaging. So Facebook is their, they don't even go on the internet, they go on Facebook. Facebook is their window into the whole world. So, you know, unless you've got a Facebook app, you haven't got a prayer in this sort of space. Okay, which takes me on to this issue about the fuzzy boundaries, because you think you're young and hip and down with the kids, but that next generation puts you to shame, because the younger kids have grown up in an entirely, you must see, like, you see those videos on YouTube of like little babies looking perplexed at a magazine, because when they touch it, nothing happens. They think a magazine is a broken iPad. It doesn't do anything. You see little toddlers, 2-3 years old, going to TV screens and going like this when they want to turn over the TV. That's already become part of that kind of zeitgeist, right? So the quote of the Bozo guy I was talking to in the States, that said his little girl who was 4 years old, she wanted to make breakfast for the first time. So he said, okay, well, she wanted to make breakfast for her mum and dad. So he said, what do you want for breakfast? He said, well, we'll have toast, because he thought toast would be it. And he showed her the toaster and whatever. So he's showing that, you know, you put the bread in, you press it down, and she said, do you put the toast in portrait or landscape? That's 4 years old. Right? So this is my youngest son. This is in, actually, does anybody know what that is? Is that curiosity?
In China.
There's no gamers here, you don't play Age of Empires. That's the Temple of Heaven in Beijing, right? And we turn around the corner into the square with my son. It's the Temple of Heaven. I'm like, oh my God, that's fantastic. And my son says, wow, it's the Temple of Heaven. And I'm like, that's fantastic. Did you learn that in geography? You were studying the Far East? Or did you learn in history because you're learning about China? Or was it in cultural studies? You know, I'm amazed that you know. Where did you learn? He goes, oh, it's in Age of Empires. Because in Age of Empires, Temple of Heaven is one of the wonders you can build if you're the Chinese. My kids are very strong on history that happened inside Age of Empires. The fall of the Holy Roman Empire, the Battle of Saladin at the Hattin, they're pretty strong on that. Anything outside that range, we've got a bit of catching up to do. They don't see those things as being real or virtual, right? So if you said to my son, you know, you've got to go do your chores, you've got to clean up some leaves in the yard or whatever, and I'm going to pay you £5 or 500 World of Warcraft dollars or whatever, it doesn't mean anything different. You know what I mean? Like to us, or to me at least, you have this kind of mental thing that somehow pounds and dollars are special and other things aren't quite so special. And you have this idea that some things are real and some things are virtual. I have to tell you, by the way, it's the 40th anniversary. Did you know this is the 40th anniversary of money being completely unreal? That's why it's having a bit of a midlife crisis, because it's actually 40. The money that we have today only goes back to the 15th of August 1971, when Richard Nixon ended the convertibility of the US dollar into gold. So this is why we tried buying a sports car, we wanted to be in England, it didn't really. It's still unhappy. It's still unhappy.
Real and virtual are words that you use, and those are words that are disappearing. Okay? So in the world of social commerce, there's no, so this is commerce within groups and communities, there's no difference between sending money from England to France, as you were talking about, or England to the Netherlands, as you were talking about. That's no different from sending money from ICQ to Farmville or to Twitter. You see what I mean? Like, those are artificial things. There's no, so social commerce, community-based commerce, isn't about geographic communities anymore. And by the way, this does have an implication in monetary development, because I'm sure it isn't central to what you're thinking about at the moment. But many of the people who are looking for alternatives to fiat currency, I don't want to speak to debt about later on, there are groups of people who are looking for more community-centered kinds of currencies as a way forward in the future. And traditionally, they tended to think of those on quite local geographical basis. So you have things like Birmal Bucks and the Brixton Pound and so on. But actually, I feel these kinds of communities are probably a stronger route. So finding a community that wants to use the new kind of payment is also a strong possibility. Okay, fraud, terror, yeah. So I do want to make a point here about... this is why I think you're so wrong with this thing about anonymity. Because people do want to know who they're sending money to at the other end of the line. They don't need to know exactly, which is a point I'll make, which somebody was talking at lunchtime about putting a layer over the top of Bitcoin. I think that's quite strong thinking. We'll come back to that. So this is a picture, I'm trying to use personal examples. So this is a picture of me. This is in the reception of a major financial institution in London. It's not fair to say who they were. So this was last year when there was a G something or other demonstration in London. And you know, there were various rabble going up and down Cannon Street complaining about, I don't know, everything generally, capitalism, the financial system, whatever. And so I had a meeting at the bank, right? So we got an email from the bank which said, please don't wear a suit to the meeting tomorrow because it might inflame the protesters. Because obviously I look pretty good in a suit. Those protesters, they weren't well dressed. Right? So I'm sure that's what they meant. So like, I didn't want to inflame the protesters, so I thought, well, actually, the corollary must be true. So if I don't want to inflame the protesters, I'll dress as a protester. So I went completely dressed in black from head to foot. I was also wearing black trousers. Black, I was wearing black gloves as well, but I took long to sign the visitor's book. And I was wearing a black balaclava and dark glasses, and I walked in and said, oh, hello, I've got a 10 o'clock meeting with so-and-so. And they're like, oh, okay, look, and they gave me a badge. That's identity in the real world. It's theatre, right? There isn't any real security. People just play it. I went to a meeting in New York a couple of weeks ago, right? And they said, you can't come into the building without some ID. But I'd left my ID locked up in the safe at the hotel. I always do. Because I'm English, and we don't have any tradition of carrying ID cards or papers. We regard that as a bizarrely continental imposition. So I went to New York, and I don't have it. And so I'm looking at the guy says, you have to have some ID to come in. So I'm looking in the bottom of my bag, and I found my England Football Supporters Club card from 1997. I'd been scanning it in the office for mucking about with something else, right? So I produced, you know, a 15-year-old England Supporters Club card, and they let me into the building. That's not security. That's security theatre. That's people acting in a play about security, but no actual security, right? And that's an extreme example. But even if you look at the existing credit card system as it stands now, you know 80% of all fraud on EU-issued payment cards is in the US because they still use the magnetic stripe instead of the chip. So if you can deliver some more security, there actually is a ready market for that, right? You know, at the moment, like, I use my credit card for everything, right? You have a sort of moral hazard around this. I would never use Bitcoin to buy anything online. I would always use my credit card. One thing, I get British Airways miles with my credit card, right, at the expense of poor people who don't have one. Secondly, if anything goes wrong, it's not my problem, right? So if it turns out you are a fraudster and you don't send me, I don't care, because I just call up my bank and they take care of it. That's why I like using the credit card, right? But if you could, but underneath that, they could use some more security. So if you can bring in more security, that can really work. Now, When I talk about identity, I mean, I want to make one more point about identity. By introducing stronger identity, that doesn't mean you know who everybody is. What it means is you know that someone knows who everybody is, right? So if you want to think of it in a different way, imagine my bank would give me a credit card that didn't have my name on the front. Or imagine my bank would let me choose the name on the front of my credit card, right? So on my credit card, I want it to say Carlos Tevez, right? So on the front of my credit card, it says Carlos Tevez. Now, when I go around buying things, it's all in the name of Carlos Tevez. I can't do anything bad with that. I can't use it to buy drugs or guns or I can in the US, but I mean in other places, I'm sure. So if I do something bad with that, then the police will go to the bank and say, who's Carlos Tevez? And the bank will say, well, it's Dave Birch. But if the bank will only say that when they're presented with a warrant, that means the merchants who see that I'm Carlos Tevez can never know that I'm Dave Birch unless I choose to tell them. If they want to pay me for my identity through some sort of loyalty scheme or reward scheme, that's fine. That's an explicit bargain which is completely separate. So I'm arguing for privacy, not anonymity. And I think an institution that offers me appropriate privacy would have a pretty strong chance of getting some of this new business. You don't have to offer anonymity. It's the other way around. I don't want an anonymous payment system. I wouldn't use it. So this is what I call safe commerce. How can we change to safe commerce? I want to, you know, this doesn't have to be super complicated. Here's a simple example. This is iPhone, right? iPhoto. You know, with your Mac you get iPhoto. You know, you go and click on the names and then it goes through all of the other pictures and says, is this the same person? And clicks them all up. That, you know, that's for free now in iPhoto, right? So it's a pretty small step to make. In fact, does anybody here know what Square is in the US? Square is the little device you can plug into your iPhone to take card payments. And they have a service called Square Card Case. So if you're a customer, you load your cards into your card case. What happens is, you walk into a shop carrying your iPhone that's running Square. Okay? The merchant has an iPad or a Mac or whatever. On the merchant's screen, he sees a list of all of the people that are in the shop. Okay? So when you want to pay, so you know, I buy a can of Coke, I want to pay, the guy says, so I just go, I'm Dave Birch. Right? And the guy can see, oh yeah, there's Dave Birch, and he hits okay. I don't even have to give him a card. I don't sign for anything. It just like that, it's just done. And it's a pretty small step from doing something like that to adding simple face recognition, you know, which narrows down the number of people it might be, blah, blah, blah. So, let's make things really safe, but you've got to make them safe in a usable way to make it easy. And by the way, other people are doing that. Okay, and finally, the fifth example is what I call chips with everything. This is it's a stupid picture to put up here, but I wanted to have one of those pictures. You must be bored to death of these. So this is me using an XT286.
Wow.
In San Francisco back in 1982. Wasn't even running Windows, that's running Xenix 2.2. So for some of our younger viewers, that was an early variant of something called Unix, which you now know as Linux. And you've all seen the statistics. You know, your wristwatch has more computing power than the moonshot, blah, blah, blah. So if you think of what the power that PC had, which is absolutely inconsequential compared to the power that I have in the smartphone already. That's a pretty, you know what? I think this is an amazing picture. I think this picture should be in a museum somewhere. The amazing thing about this picture isn't my hair, which I agree was. The amazing thing about this picture is I'm smoking a cigarette. Look at that. Inside a building in San Francisco. Tell the kids of today that, they just wouldn't believe me. Right, so the point is that computing power and the new interfaces like RFID and so on mean that you can put commerce into everything. So the idea that commerce is about a person and a merchant or a shop or a point of sale, that's disappearing. Commerce is about the Internet of Things as much as it is about the Internet of People. It's about things buying stuff from other things as well as people buying from other people. And I just want to show you one very quick example. This is from London Fashion Week, where I'm often seen, of course. Because here I was wearing last year's Rich Brothers shirt. This is from the autumn collection, obviously. These autumnal browns, I think, fit with the mood at times. So this is from London Fashion Week, and we did some work with Telefonica O2. So basically what happened is the models go down the catwalk, and the I can see it's a predominantly male audience. So I'll flesh this out very slightly by saying it's not as much fun as it sounded. Right, because when you first get told we'd like you to go to London Fashion Week and sort this out, you're like, oh my god, this is going to be fantastic, right? Models, whatever. When you get there, people are crying and screaming and chasing around everywhere. It's absolute chaos. And then when the show starts and the models are actually coming down towards you, and it's dark and the lights are flashing, and the models are all very tall and they're very angular, and it's quite a scary. It was like something from Aliens, you know, when they come down the corridor. It's very horrifying, it's not what you think. And they were all wearing, they were wearing paper kites and sleeping bags and holes. These are about the only two things I could find that actually look like clothes. But these posters and the clothes, these have NFC chips inside. And the fashion buyers were all issued with telephonic Nokias. Actually, I haven't got one with me at the moment to show you. They were all issued with Nokia phones, so basically the fashion buyers, they saw the models came down the catwalk, then when they come out, the clothes are lined up, and they just take the phone, they touch the ones they're interested in. And when you touch it, it brings up on the screen a little picture of the clothes, the name of the designer, and you can hit OK. And at the end of the day, the designers got mailed a list of all of the buyers that were interested in their clothes and vice versa. The reason I use that as an example is because those aren't you, right? These are people who are barely technologically functional. These are people who were crying while I was trying to explain to them what to do. They don't know how to use anything in a web browser. You're wasting your time. If you ask them to download something, or not in a million years, right? But they understand the grammar of phones. With 5 minutes, here, look, you take the phone, you touch it, they were able to engage in a new form of commerce. Okay, to summarise then, there are five new areas for commercial transactions where I think you could put a layer on it to make it attractive. So one is the spontaneous mobile payer. Forget about PCs and the internet and whatever, that's yesterday's thing, that's for old people like me. For the mass market, it's phones, phone to phone. Look at what Square, if you want to see how to put a nice, go and look at what people like Square are doing, because they'll blow your mind. It's got to be streaming, it's got to be continuous and connected. It's got to be interconnected through social media, and I think, basically, I'm sorry to say it, but you know, you have to have a Facebook app. If you don't have a Facebook app, you can't play in that kind of space. You know, you've already got Facebook credits being extended out to other websites. You want a million users before Apple comes along with its wallet? Facebook's got 800 million users. And for most of those people, the idea of using Facebook credits on other websites, nothing. Absolutely no brainer. It's got to be safe. I wish I had a better answer to that. I'm not sure what the answer to that is. But we have to go down the OpenID 2.0.2 route. For some of you who are interested in this sort of thing, the US National Strategy for Trusted Identities in Cyberspace sets up this framework where you have a pseudonymous private identifier. I've got a feeling that might be worth exploring. And finally, you've got to think about the Internet of Things. That means go and look at what they're doing with Google Wallet. Google Wallet will just blow you away. And Google Wallet has one thing that you desperately need. Google Wallet on the Android phones, like the Nexus, the S2, they have the secure element. So they're not using the SIM-based secure element of the operator. They've got their own secure element in the handset. That means they have tamper-resistant hardware in the handset using standard Java global platform interfaces. And you need somewhere secure in the handset to store private keys. So, I hope that's given you, I don't want to be too negative, I hope that's given you a few positive ideas. Okay, thanks very much.
Okay, so that was a really insightful talk. Thank you for your comments. I wish we could go longer, but we're running a bit short for time. After these next chunk of money-related talks, there is going to be a Q&A session where you can ask questions to people afterwards. So our next speaker is Simon Dixon from the futureofbanking.com. Bank to the future.com. And he's going to be talking about banking. Okay, actually, this is, go ahead, a quick question. So maybe we can quickly ask.
My question is, Mr. Bridge, maybe it's irrelevant, but I think, are you pro Bitcoin or you are skeptic?
I'm very skeptical. I'm very skeptical, but I'm honest about my skepticism. So I think there are elements in the Bitcoin experience which are very valuable to the construction of the future system, but I don't see Bitcoin as a standard of the future system. Because it's jumbling up. It's,
yeah, we will talk about this later on. It's actually good to have skeptics here, because if you're always just telling yourself what the truth is, then you might as well just be reading from like the Quran and Madrasa, brainwashing yourself. technical issues. Okay, we'll take one more question from Stefan.
Okay, so one of the main points that I took away from the talk is that we should focus on mobile phones and on Facebook and things like that. And one problem that I see in that space is we have a Bitcoin Facebook app and we have Bitcoin iPhone apps that are native, but these platforms are controlled. So what happened with the iPhone apps is that it simply didn't get into the App Store because Apple rejected it. I was wondering if you have advice for any comments on how to get around these restrictions?
I can't comment on the Apple Store because I honestly don't know. I mean, you need a brand umbrella really to sneak into something like that. But it's, Tony was saying earlier on, Bitcoin is the thing that's underneath, but that's not the thing that's presented. To me, that seems like a plausible strategy for moving that forward. But yes, no, I'm very much positive.
Yeah, actually, there's a difference of opinion, like within the community itself, about whether it's Bitcoin is the underlying infrastructure, or whether Bitcoin itself as a system is like what's being said. It's a debate that's going on. But there is one thing though. It's if we look at Citibank, only a few months ago, Citibank had 1% of their 21 million customers' credit card details leaked on the internet, names, date of birth, security code, card number, everything. And Sony, 120 million accounts hacked. So really, when we're talking about security, we say banks are secure. They're not really secure. Like, I had a friend of mine, his account was shut down, and he's lost 15,000 euros that he's had to spend months trying to
resolve. I was very clear. If there is a way of increasing real security, I think there is an opportunity there. So, You lose a million credit card numbers as a customer, I don't care, it's not so important, it's the bank.
So our next speaker is Simon Dixon. He's going to be starting now.
Hello everybody, very happy to be here at the European Bitcoin Conference. My first time in Prague. Just out of curiosity, has anyone watched any of my videos? Anyone familiar with my work at all? Okay, just a few of you. Right, well, my name is Simon Dixon. I am the founder of BankToTheFuture.com, and I'm the author of Bank to the Future, Protect Your Future Before Governments Go Bust. For the last 5 years, I've been working on marketing a particular message and a particular school of thought towards what we think needs to change in the banking system in order to create some kind of sustainability under a fiat currency system. Before I started as a banking reformer, I come from an investment banking background. I started in the city as a stockbroker. I worked as a trader, as a market maker for an investment bank in the London Stock Exchange, and then worked as an investment banker before setting up a business which was centered around the next generation of investment bankers. We own the world's leading trading company for students and graduates seeking careers in investment banking. We've had 10,000 people through our training programs, and we've had about 100,000 people. We've got a database of 100,000 people. All of the future investment bankers, fund managers, or students and graduates that have ambitions of having an impact in the banking system at some point. A couple of years ago, we started working on Bank to the Future, and our goal was to create an alternative non-bank social network financial institution, which we're due to launch in March 2012. And so for me to have the opportunity to speak with you guys, I'd like to share with you about what I think needs to happen in order to create some kind of disruption in the banking system. So just to frame my talk, I'd say the theme of the last 10 or 20 years has really been centered around rapid, fast disruption. If you look at disruption before the Industrial Revolution, leading up to the Industrial Revolution, the time frame between a new innovation and some main mass adoption was around about 25 years, then 20 years when we see the TV steam frame, and then it was 15 years, and then it came down to 5 years. And now we see someone like Mark Zuckerberg create Facebook, and immediately, within a tiny period of time, we're really, 5 years, and a few years later, he's got 800 million users adopting such a, and that's all due to technological innovation. So we've seen the traditional media industry all be disrupted with social media. We've seen the music industry completely disrupted through iTunes. We've seen the traditional advertising industry completely disrupted through Google and the others. We've seen the book industry disrupted by buying books online, and then the buying books online disrupted by the Kindle and iBooks and various other innovations out there. I put this diagram up here because when I started in our business about 4 years ago, we were given a call from BT, and their salesman gave us this most amazing pitch about the future of telephony. And that it could all be done through the internet, and there was this amazing way of saving money on your calls. And we really got sucked into this pitch. And a few meetings later, we spent about £8,000 with British Telecom, and we got this system where we were all operating off Macs, and our office was fully Macs. And they said that you needed to install. They didn't tell us this, but they told us later, once we spent £8,000, that we needed to install Parallels for one, because we couldn't run it on Mac, and we had to use and we had to all kill our Macs by turning them into PCs, which really slowed down everything and everything we were doing. And the system never got working. And I think about after about a year of fighting the company. If those of you that are not in the UK, British Telecom, the main telephony company. We realised that we just paid £8,000 and completely screwed up our business for Skype. And it didn't work as well as Skype. And it didn't really do anything that Skype wanted to do. So we've seen this massive, massive disruption to traditional industries. Now, the telephone industry has not been fully disrupted yet. But, it's only a question of time, really, before everything's free. And by the way, I'm not an advocate of everything being free. For those of you that are developers in the open source movement, I think that the free movement is very disruptive to the economy. It only causes unemployment. So when you think that the answer to disrupting an industry is to give everything away free and really attack a company, what you're going to find is that's going to really, really screw up our economy as we know it today. It only causes unemployment when you do that. And one of the main reasons why record numbers of people are finding it so hard to get jobs right now is because everything's becoming free, and someone's got to pay their wages at the end of the day. Not everyone can be an entrepreneur and a programmer. Although I think we're in an entrepreneurial revolution, I don't particularly like revolutions. I believe in evolution. I think a lot of people get hurt during a revolution, and I prefer to see some kind of evolution personally. But anyway, a little side point. We've even seen the traditional charity model get disrupted through microfinance movement and the emergence of the social enterprise. If anyone's read Richard Branson's new book, it's called Screw Business as Usual, and it's all about how being good to the world, being good to the planet, being good to people is very, very beneficial to profits and bottom line at the moment. So we've seen this emergence of new businesses, and I really, really genuinely believe the business and entrepreneurship and capitalism is the key to actually getting back to some kind of sustainability. But we need a paradigm shift, and we need people doing things for different reasons. And that's where the social enterprise and the social entrepreneur come in for me. But one thing that we have not seen disrupted, and I ask the question why, are the things that we most need disrupted in the world right now. There's three things that we need most, I think disruption needs to occur more than anything else in the world. The first is that industries are actually, I've put here a different slide here first. Firstly, why did all these disruptions actually happen? Well, the first reasons why they happen is there's an appetite for change. So when David was presenting earlier on you've got to align yourself with what's actually happening in the real world, there's got to be an appetite for change. And I think we can all agree that there is a tremendous appetite for change in banking right now. The challenge is that people are happy to slag off the banks, they're happy to go nuts at the banks, they're happy to sit outside Wall Street, but at the end of the day, they still need to make their payments and they still trust banks, even though they completely distrust banks because they're not moving their money. The other thing that you need after an appetite for change is you need a better way of actually doing things. That's where the entrepreneurs come in, that's why I love capitalism, that's where the whole social enterprise model comes in, because somebody has got to be motivated to innovate some kind of change and find a better way of doing things. And I believe that there's no better model for running an economy or a world in capitalism for incentivizing people to find better ways of doing things. And that's why we've had all that disruption. For those of you that, I recently presented at Occupy London, which I thoroughly enjoyed. And I was presenting to a lot of the anti-capitalists on the benefits of capitalism and why we're not actually in any kind of capitalism right now. It was an interesting experience. The video's on YouTube, and in 4 days it had about 5,000 views, which to me is just incredible that you can just get a message out there. 800,000 views on a Bitcoin. We live in a time like no other. Today, while we're having massive, massive disruption, there's some really horrible things happening in the world, but in parallel, we're having the most interesting free time in history, where if you have an internet connection, a laptop, and a smartphone, more is possible than ever. What I feel sorry for is those people that don't have the internet connection, that don't have a smartphone, and don't have a laptop. And us as entrepreneurs, as innovators, I think it's up to us to innovate things, which is why I'm against the whole free movement of making everything free, because we need to employ those people that aren't entrepreneurs and innovators to create some kind of sustainability. So anyway, once we have an appetite for change and a better way of doing things, you also need a team of believers, and that's what I believe this conference is about. A team of people getting together that believe in it, that have all different skill sets to get out there in the world. And you also need a route to market, because if we're all sat around here in a Bitcoin conference discussing it, it does not make a difference at all unless you can communicate it in a way where other people can understand the benefits of actually using that. As technology people, we tend to not have the right skill set sometimes. I'm not a technology person myself, but I employ a lot of technology people, and I wouldn't put them anywhere near the marketing department at all. So we need to communicate it in a way. But there's three industries, or three things, which have not been disrupted at all. And I asked the question why, and I'd also like to give you a theory of why I think as well. The first is industries that absolutely kill our planet. They seem not to be disrupted at all, despite the fact that entrepreneurs and innovators are creating all the technology that we need in order to do things in a way that doesn't disrupt our planet, that doesn't kill our planet. They still, the industries that are still killing our planet with no sustainability still exist. The second industries that never get disrupted are the industries that kill people. And yet, for some reason, what kind of sustainability? I guess if you could kill people, there'd probably be a lot of sustainability in the world, because we seem to screw a lot of things up, but we also do a lot of good. So industries that kill people have not been disrupted at all, despite the fact that we've had all this technological innovation. In fact, quite the opposite. And the third industry that just seems completely undisruptible is banking. Now, why is that? I've got a theory of why that actually is, and that's what I've been doing as a banking reformer for the last 5 years, is I've been pitching, I've been working with members of parliament, some not-for-profits that we work with, got the opportunity to put in a submission for the Independent Commission on Banking in the UK. And we've been working very, very strongly to get in a number of different areas. In education, because I own the largest training company for future investment bankers. In business, because we're creating an alternative financial institution using social networks. And thirdly, through not-for-profit and politics, and working with, I had the opportunity to speak alongside a couple of members of parliament a couple of weeks ago. And it was amazing. In the UK, we have about 600 members of parliament. From my speaking, four of them truly understood money and the nature of money and how money is created. And I believe that the reason that these industries have not been disrupted is purely because of the way money is actually created. And that's why me, as a banking reformer, we look to change the rules of money and banking. Because although I'm very excited about creating an entrepreneur revolution alternatives, I also know that there's got to be things that happen at the governmental level in order for these things to go through. With the exception of a few things, and one of those is creating a complete alternative currency, such as Bitcoin. So there's three flaws that we believe in banking, and I just want to touch upon these briefly because they lay into what I'd like to speak for the rest of the presentation. The first is this, and this is why those three industries have not been disrupted, and they won't be disrupted until these three flaws looked at. The first is this, not many people know this, but when you deposit your money with a bank, they become the legal owner of your money. So it actually becomes legally their money. The second thing is that once it becomes legally their money, banks decide how they spend it through issuing loans. So really, the banks are deciding and allocating by the way, 97% of our money is being allocated by banks. And so if it's not drawing a profit, then they'll put it to the unsustainable nature or whatever it may be. But they're really dictating where almost all of our money in our nation actually is spent. And the third thing, which we think is the third floor of banking and the reason why we have such industries that can't get disrupted, is because banks actually create money. So you may not know this, or you may know this, but when you go and borrow a mortgage, essentially that's just brand new money created out of thin air by a bank. In the UK, we have a legal system whereby banks can simply create as much money as people will borrow, or appetite to lend to them. So really, there's only two things dictating where money goes in our economy. One is if someone's willing to borrow and they have the credit rating which meets the criteria of a bank. And secondly, whether they can find people to borrow that money, which is why we believe that we're in this unsustainable industry. In the UK, we're particularly bad because our legislation is particularly bad. In America, it's less, but we've got 97% of all our nation's money supply is created through a bank as credit, which actually means that every single penny, with the exception of some coins and cash, in our economy is associated with debt, which is why we have to continually, all policies in the government is about increasing debt, getting government increase debt, the solution to the financial crisis. Anyone ever try to get out of debt by taking on more debt? Well, that seems to be our solution, and our policies are all dictated around that. That's simply because money is debt, and that's the way our economies are structured. So we have some reforms in what we've pitched to the Independent Commission on Banking to how you can transition from this unsustainable nature, where those three industries will never be disrupted, to some kind of sustainability. And I don't want to go into those right now because that's not what this talk is about. So how can we actually disrupt banking then? The indisruptible, the industry that just seems to be indisruptible. Why is it indisruptible? Because it's actually, if we took away banking, we would have a massive, massive depression like never before. Because all money is created by a bank. If you actually take that money away, we'd only have 3% of the money in our economy. So it's pretty hard to let a bank go bust, and it's pretty hard to make any kind of reform when you rely on banks for the actual creation of money, which is why I believe no other reform, no other movement, no other disruption can occur until that's a governmental issue, and they've got to actually decide how they're going to take back that power. But why do we need banks? Well, there's several reasons why we might need banks. Firstly, we need that for payments, and I'd like to look at the disruptions that could be caused in this industry. Secondly, we can look at funding. I put here the productive economy because the way banking actually works right now is only 8% of money actually goes to the productive economy. And by productive, I mean people looking to make a difference in the world, people creating business, people looking to create some kind of value added All the rest of the money goes on commodity speculation, creating bubbles in the world, creating property bubbles, and the 8% makes its way to the productive economy. If you go into a bank right now and you're credit worthy, and you said to the bank, could I borrow £10,000 please? They say, what do you want it for? And if you said, well, I'd like to redecorate my house, they'd say, well, let me just look up your credit rating. And if your credit rating's good, are they going to give you that money? Hell yeah, they'll give you that money. If you went into the same bank and said, hi, I'm the same person, but what I want to use that for is actually for my business, because I've got this brilliant idea of this new thing that's going to really make a difference in the world, are they going to give you that money? Hell no. So we think everything's backwards. Because it's all consumer spending and it's mortgages and creating property bubbles, and hence the reason why where we are today. Okay. Is that time out? Or was that fine?
Give it a few seconds.
Okay, and that realized how fun I was talking to. The other industry is helping savers. The other thing we need a bank for is helping savers invest, because people do want to get a return on their money and put it somewhere safe. And the fourth is to provide a market for currency. So I'm just going to go through some of the disruptions we've actually seen. You may have heard of the story of Oyster Card. So one of the disruptions that happened in Hong Kong is there was this card called Octopus Card before we had Oyster Card in London. Sorry, I forgot that I'm not speaking to English people here. English, British people, sorry. And we had this, there was a system in the Hong Kong, and they started allowing people to deposit money and on their travel card system, which is where you just swipe your card through near-field communication, and you could get onto the transport system. And they started allowing people to put extra additional money, and then merchants started offering it and allowing people to spend on that money. It became hugely, hugely popular. A lot of the banks started complaining that Octopus Card is actually engaging in banking activities, and they're an unlicensed bank, essentially, because they're allowing people to take deposits and make payments. So the Hong Kong Central Bank at the time investigated this, and they said, yeah, hold on, Octopus Card is getting involved in banking here, and the bankers wanted to take away the banking license, or take away and make sure that Octopus Card could no longer do this. The result was that the Hong Kong Central Bank decided to actually give Octopus Card a banking license. So, you know, we've had these huge disruptions. There's no reasons why we can't do that in the UK, because the difference between Octopus Card is that they're engaging in banking the way most people think banking works. They're simply, you're putting money on deposit and you're spending. And so rather than actually creating money and leveraging and using it for speculation and all this stuff and allocating where the money goes to, there's sustainability in that system. We've seen that Dave talked about, he was responsible and behind a consulting M-Pesa where Vodafone almost accidentally became the largest bank in Kenya. And if they can do it through SMS and allow people to actually, you know, spend money through SMS in what seems to be a secure environment, seems to have been extremely successful, why can't we actually do it here? And I put it to you that the main reason behind that is because of the banking industry. We're out of time now. Okay. I'm just gonna close then by talking about some of the alternatives for funding and investing. I'm the founder of Bank to the Future. Myself and my wife created that, and we wanted to create a social network where people can fund, borrow, raise funds, and invest. Now, one of the important things that we wanted to do, and one of the reasons why I wanted to come here, is because I wanted to see and work with some of you Bitcoin developers to see if we can integrate with some kind of alternative currency as well, and how we might actually do that. But what we're actually doing in Bank to the Future is we're only investing in the productive economy. So if people have businesses, if people have ideas, then they can do that through a number of different models, which I won't get in here today. But if you wanted to raise funds for your iPhone app development or something like that, we've got a number of different products of how we're going to achieve that. So we're helping people raise startup capital, growth capital, venture capital, and there's some other things that we're going to be doing that we don't have time to go into. So what I just wanted to do is... if anyone would like to contact me, there's all the details. I'm going to be around for the rest of the conference. I'm extremely easy to connect to or contact through the social networks. And thank you very much, sir. I can do one.
Bitcoin talk. One thing is when you said about anarchists using the term anti-capitalism. So yeah, I have friends who are anarcho-capitalists and anarcho-communists who come from and anarcho-syndicalists and volunteerists. The thing to realize though is that they're all speaking about the same thing, but and they've all arrived at the same conclusion but from different angles. So actually when someone says anti-capitalist, they're actually saying they're against corporatism. They're not against a free market or a marketplace. It's something they like. Okay, so thank you. We don't have much time for questions, but there's going to be questions after the next set of speakers. Our next speaker is Jason Chia. He's a barrister with a specialization in corporate law and oil and gas. He's a member of a Bitcoin consultancy. He's a Bitcoin lawyer.
Intended to be used as a unit of exchange, which Bitcoin is intended to use like fiat exchange. And a commodity is anything that has a general consumptive use that is homogeneous and, well, different or alike. And it also could be used as a unit of exchange, which fit with it. So, whilst I may concur either it's more than, whether it's more like 50-50 in my eyes, whether it's a commodity or a currency. But on the other hand, if you think of carbon credits, they're seen as a form of commodity, which if we look at Bitcoin, say, the carbon credits could be a form of commodity, why not Bitcoin? Worth at all. And in the market, MT Gox calls them an internet commodity. I've listed down a few pointers on what Bitcoin actually is. Digital currency, central authority, no central authority, but I think you're all well aware of that. Is Bitcoin legal? That's the question I get asked a lot. Well, legal in what sense? I'd say it is not legal tender. Because you cannot walk into a shop and decide to pay in Bitcoins. In UK, pounds is legal tender because they're obliged to take your money in pounds or in the States, the dollar. So, of course, you could use Bitcoins when you go to the grocery store. It's up to the grocer whether they'd like to accept in exchange of apples and bananas. So, is Bitcoin legal in the sense of it's legal tender? No. And I thought of defining a Bitcoin in an S&P agreement. If you decide to one day purchase something significant, something large, house, maybe in Bitcoins, worth roughly one of these up. So I define it as a unit or token of exchange transferred using, and it's important that you define what software or client that you're using. There are currently two, I'm aware, Limitcoin and Bitcoin Client 0.5. From X to Y address, each address consisting of 32 to 35 characters, after having achieved 6-8 confirmations. Brief background into how we got here today with e-money regulations. On the 1st of May, the second EMV was implemented across Europe. It was implemented in the UK this year through the EMR regulations. It sets out generally the rules that apply, that a firm must apply if they'd like to become an authorized money, e-money issuer. Now, the European Commission estimates that the market for e-money will grow up to 10 billion by 2012. Perhaps it could be larger than that if Bitcoin is classified as e-money. So what is e-money? It is electronically, including magnetically stored monetary value that is essentially represented by a claim on an issuer. Means if you present it to an issuer, they'd have to give you back whatever you exchange it for initially. And that it is issued on receipt of funds, for example.
We have the value of rate in the long run.
Wait, one second. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah, sure.
Because otherwise you won't go in the recording.